Welcome back to the Rising Scribe podcast. My guest today is Robert Silverman.
So, Bob, what's your favorite piece you've written?
My favorite piece? I really love the one I wrote about the Native American high school basketball team. That's my go-to answer.
What was the inspiration behind that?
You know, it was a weird thing. I was working for a company. It was my day job. My day job has sort of vanished in the last or so, leaving me as a full-time adult freelancer. So I was working for a production company that was producing a documentary film. And part of it was shot out in Wyoming. And one of the subjects of the film was in New York for the Tribeca Film Festival. So we were hanging out and talking. And I told him that, yes, I blog about sports for a living, specifically basketball, mainly. And God, this is back in April 2013. And he said, oh, really? Have you heard of the Wyoming Indian Chiefs? And he's like, no. And he said, oh, my God, they're amazing. The best team in Wyoming. Take that for what you will. But they are the best, probably one of the best. They are the best high school basketball team in Wyoming. And he was like, oh, you got to go see them play. You got to go see them play. And I said, okay. And, you know, it took a while to find a way to get out to Wyoming for less than an arm and a leg and find the time to go spend, 10 days in Wyoming. But I did, and it was, the first draft of that piece was probably about 16,000 words long, and there's much more that I got. It's about 5 or 6 interviews that I wanted to find a place for that I couldn't find, and there's just so much there. I mean, I really just stuck to the basketball and what the kids played on it thought and what the parents played on it thought and some of that, but, like, there's a ton of history about the area and the entire, and Native American struggles in America and Native American assimilation in America and all this other stuff that could not fit even into a long-form, sports article. So it was really, that's the kind of stuff I like. It's, I can sit here on my couch not wearing pants and talk about, my feels about any particular team or play or moment or anything like that. But actually doing the old school, journalism thing of going out to places and meeting people and talking to them and finding out what their lives are like and then writing some words about it, that's exciting to me. That was my favorite piece for a bunch of different reasons because I was surprised because I had no idea what to expect. And it was all, I was wrong half the time. More than half the time, probably.
Did you do any background research beforehand, or was this kind of, all right, I'm going to Wyoming?
Oh, no, I did a ton. I mean, I read everything that I could find about the team. There's a documentary that actually PBS, I found that PBS did about 12 years ago about them, which is kind of a problematic documentary.
Right.
I read... Why was it problematic?
I think I remember that in your piece, where people, they're pretty upset about it, right?
They were very upset about it. I mean, they felt exploited by it. They felt like, it was one of those, oh, yeah, but look, all these kids are it felt like all of the worst aspects of Hoop Dreams that it was setting them up to point out only the worst aspects of life in that part of the world.
Right.
And they were kind of sensationalistic. It spoke about, here are the kids hanging out, drinking 40s and smoking illegal substances, which they're teenage kids. Come on. You can find, unless you're like doing a really in-depth documentary on Mormon basketball, I don't think you're going to find any. And you like super clean kids. Of course they're going to do that. And, yes, there is poverty there, but it ended up feeling like, and that's part of the story, but not presented in a way that felt like it was from their point of view. A lot of the media depictions are about Native American life, or it feels like, and yes, it is, it feels like white people coming in and telling them how they're failing. And the thing they kept saying is, stop judging us by your standards. You don't know what you're talking about. And I'm sure I still don't know what I'm talking about. I mean, I did a whole bunch of research, but I was there for 10 days. So I know nothing. But I tried to make that clear in the piece. Like, I don't know what this world is, but here's what I encountered here. And here's how, here's how this is not what you think. And here's how they're not being allowed to tell their story.
Now, I remember that you ran into a lot of distrust, I think, at first, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it distrust. They were very welcoming, but there was a bit of a sort of like, are you going to do this again?
Ah.
I mean, like every time they encountered someone who wasn't local media, that's what happened. I mentioned this in the article also. There was a Times story that came in and talked about, like, you know, the descent of the police force into their area after a killing and how it was an excuse to militarize an area based on the fact that they could be treated as an other, that, you know, they're treated as an outsider in this country, even though, you know, we kind of took it from them.
Yeah.
And killed many, many of them. But they're the other now. And that the police force, when they came in, didn't clean up crime. It actually only made things worse, which is what happens when you turn an area into a militarized zone, as we've seen in places like, you know, Ferguson. And everywhere we encounter a military that's armed, a police/military force that's armed to the teeth and acts like an occupier, there's a natural resistance from people who feel like they're being occupied. God, I had pages and pages on that, but like no time. But they were distrustful, and I hoped, I tried the best of my can just to be like, okay, you know, it's something, it's really interesting. This is something that I tried to do, and I don't always succeed, but it's something I tried to do when I, years ago, you know, when I was still making plays. But one of the first big things I did is myself and a bunch of friends of mine, we went to Southeast Asia because we met these Thai actors and Indonesian actors at a theater festival. And they said to us, come with us back to Thailand and make a play with us. And we were like, about what? And they said, well, you know, about being a 22, 23-year-old Thai person in 1997. And we said, we know nothing about that. We can't play about that. We have no idea what that means. I mean, like, none. I mean, there's not even, like, an American lexicon of movies we could draw on to be like, okay, well, we think it'll be like this. It wasn't like we were going to Japan or Russia or even a country where there is some preconceived notion of what that might possibly mean, which honestly was the best thing that could have happened. So we just went in and we started interviewing each other and asking questions and starting from that basic question, which is, you know, hi, you know, your name is Pierre Wontrever. Tell me about your life. What do you love? What do you hate? You know, what was it like the first time? You know, you got a bicycle. What's, you know, tell me about this world. Like, what you do in the morning every day? What do you do at night? You know, and tell us. And we just interviewed each other, I think, for the first, God, I forget how many weeks. And then that became the script of the play. But it started out with this investigation of like, okay, this is your world. Tell us about it. And we'll figure out how that's theater. And we were there for one group went originally for a summer. I went with the second group that went back in November of 96, and I was there for probably about 3 months. We made a whole other play after that. And you know, we started with that spirit of things like, okay, I'm going to assume that I know nothing about you, but here are the questions that I have, and now you tell me. And at my best, you know, I try to remember those lessons, that I don't know anything about a group of people in a place and a time.
That also kind of seems to stress the importance of listening, which it seems like a very like logical and obvious thing, but it's actually kind of surprising how many people don't listen.
Well, it's hard. It's not easy, and I don't do it a lot myself. You know, I mean, I try to, but you have to remind yourself of that you know nothing. You know, that Tom Brady is absolutely right. I don't know anything about anything. he said the greatest truth. I loved that Tom Brady comment. I don't know anything. It was my favorite Tom Brady moment of all time. That, you know, like, actually, like, listen, like, people are fascinating animals, and they're all different and weird, and you just got to listen and try to listen better and let them tell their story, which is always going to be more interesting than the idea you had when you walked into the room, whatever the room is. Always, always, always. It's the thing, it's that same thing of like, you know, it's old newspaper ideas that the story is out there. And if you go out there to actually with a spirit of inquisition to see what it is, it's going to be better than what you think. your thoughts are boring. Your thoughts, I mean, my thoughts are very boring and dull. And I've probably said them too many times in the same version of the same thing too many different ways. But the other person's, you know, walking a mile in another person's shoes and really trying to understand what that might be is always better than your smart thoughts. And it's very hard. If it were, you know, writing about my own thoughts, I mean, it's how I got started doing the writing thing, you know, specifically about, like, the Knicks and stuff like that. But that was just my own ideas in my own head, and those ran out pretty quick.
Well, we're going to get back to the Native American story for a second, but since you brought up the Knicks and that your thoughts ran out pretty quick, I want to touch on last season because – even though last season was absolutely fucking miserable, at least for the Knicks fan, overall last season was just bad, but especially bad for you guys. But then a strange thing happened. Like a quarter of the way through, maybe half the way through, you guys started making the most amazing recaps ever.
Well, you know, it's this whole idea that, like, people who are, like, we just – you know, we had a great source material. First of all, thank you. I mean, we were just, it was so confounding. We were sitting there and we were just like, how do we explain this? And the traditional ways of writing a game or a recap just seemed insignificant because it was so weird. And so many terrible, like, they would lose in the most fantastically weird ways. That season is, you know, that was painful, but that's better than this. This is boring. This is just dull. I've written maybe one recap in the last month. One, because I'm writing other things, but two, because there's just nothing to say. And maybe that's the failure of my own creative ability to describe the same horrible turd that's been left in the middle of the floor night after night. But it's just awful. And the reason the season is harder is because taking a dump in the middle of the floor is the absolute right thing for this team to do. So you can't even criticize them for taking a dump in the middle of the floor. You just have to say, yep, it's poop. There it is. This team has been constipated for decades, and they really needed a long, like, very uncomfortable shit that, like, I think, as they said in the Fisher King, borders on the nature of existential revelation, but, like, really, really difficult poop. But that's what it is. And okay, like, for the first 20 games, I think I wrote a bunch of recaps that were like, here's the poop. And I'm just like, I don't know. But, like, it was just, you know, just the chance to write about, you know, Bargnani shooting with, like, 5 seconds left on the clock, up one, and shooting at three. Because, I don't know, because he did. You know? And it was so weird. So it's also because, like, you know, Jim was writing an amazing thing. And then Kevin would write an amazing thing. Jim Cavan and Kevin McElroy. And then Seth would write an amazing thing night after night. And I do think we pushed each other to just expand the boundaries of what we're doing in a healthy competition kind of way.
Do you feel like at some point that you cracked?
I think, like, I cared about the Knicks less. I find myself more interested in all kinds of other kinds of basketball, and it's a lot healthier. I really just don't care about – I mean, there's a game tonight, but I had to, like, remind myself. I was like, oh, yeah, there's a game. I mean, I'll watch it or not, really. There are, you know, I got three other fit stories that I really should be putting the work in on, so – maybe I will, maybe I won't. But for the first time, you know, in probably over three decades, I don't – well, there were pockets where I was doing other things too. But, like, first time in a long time, I just don't care.
Is that liberating?
Yeah, it is. It's a little sad. You know, you miss like, you know, for all the pain of last season and, like, the hateful, galling losses and this – really criminal, stupid decisions that we're making to go along with that. It's, you know, passion is invigorating, even if it's like, you know, pounding nails into the floor with your forehead. You feel something about that. And losing that, it's like, well, I don't know what to do with myself watching a game if I'm not screaming and yelling and throwing a temper tantrum. But I think you're a better writer when you're, you know, the thing of, like, feeling so enraged and needing to put it into words that's very effective. Like, that's also where that was born out of. Like, I have all these feels. I have to find some way to say something about them. And just, like, screaming, like, ah, all caps and mashing on the screen is one way, but then you find creative ways to do it. Like, I think I remember at one point, like, Kevin and I were discussing, like, the way we would recap is, like, we'd watch it, and then we would, like, sneeze and yell for a half an hour, and then be like, okay, now what? What do I say about this? And then we would go and do it. And it took all this year to be like, you know, I watched it, and I can watch what's happening. You know, if you're in a blind, sputtering rage, you're going to miss things.
Yes.
And, you know, there's a point about objective journalism here, which is to be an effective critic about something, you can't really care so much about the result. Like, you can't write about, like, crime if you're, like, related to, like, the person who's lying in, like, a pool of blood on the gutter. Like, you can't write about a story about a guy who got mugged if like, you know him. And you're pissed at the mugger. You have to be able to say, like, here's what happened. Here's why it happened. Here's how this speaks to some larger issue. And I think it's better for anyone's writing about it. I think both are interesting alleyways. And they both have their strengths and weaknesses, is what I would say.
Now we can kind of get back to the Native American story, because it's actually kind of...
How do we get back to the Native Americans from there?
Well, because you're talking about emotional investment in stories and in writing.
Yeah. I definitely had an emotional investment with that group of people.
Yeah.
I definitely did, but it wasn't like – it's a different kind of emotional investment.
It's more of a you want – this is a story that you want to tell and you want others to know. It's not of
it's the story that I felt the most responsibility to the people that I was writing about to get it right,
mm-hmm.
to say it the right way, not to let them down. Especially since they've been let down by the press time and time and time again. I just didn't want to be another white boy who came and did it and then wrote something about them and left them feeling like they shouldn't have trusted, you know, this person, and they were getting screwed over again. I felt incredibly – it was hard to write at times because I felt like I was like, am I saying this the right way? Is this going to offend them? I mean, I transcribed probably – there was like – and I had some help. I actually farmed out some of the transcription stuff. I had about 20 hours of transcribing, of interviews.
Wow.
And I would sit there and – oh, yeah. Yeah, there was 20 hours worth of interviews there. And that took a long time. I'm bad at that. More than the fact that we don't have jetpacks yet, as our failings as a modern society, I am angry about the fact that there's no automatic transcription service.
You'd think we would have perfected it by now, right?
You would think. If, you know, the newspapers weren't failing so miserably, I think some bright young entrepreneur would have come up with this. But there's really no money to be made in it, so I don't think it's going to happen. But dear God, that was hell. But in any case, I was sending them back, like, reams of the transcriptions just to be like, did I get this right? Would you like to change this, you know, a little bit now that you see it the way you said it? And you know, I just wanted to make sure that they felt like I felt so responsible to tell their story in a way, you know, and that can be a tricky thing, too, because you don't want to be writing in a place of wanting to please your subject, mm-hmm. because then again, you're torquing whatever attempt to get at an objective truth that might be. So that's a trap, too, I think. I mean, I want to put a giant caveat in front of everything I say, because I'm just, you know, starting to learn how to do all this myself. So I could be totally wrong. Please feel free to say, like, yeah, Bob, you're really wrong. But I felt really responsible to these people to say it the right way. And at times that was paralyzing in the writing process, because I would sit there and I would overanalyze, like, what I was saying and, like, is this right? Is this wrong? Is this, you know, the same questions that have popped up around Serial, where it does feel like, you know, in any instance, a journalist, unless they're writing specifically for being a part of a community, they're going to be an outsider. And again, you have a place where that's a benefit, because an outsider can often tell far more objective truths about a group of people and the place and an incident than can anyone who's involved. But there's always going to be an aspect of cultural tourism about it,
mm-hmm.
where you're coming in and you know, you're enraptured by certain things that may feel exotic or strange, but are just part of everyday life. And you may, you know, elaborate on those things or romanticize them because of your own desire to romanticize that experience. This is a hard job, is what I'm saying.
Do you feel like you accomplished that goal? Do you feel like you did right by them?
I think I did. I got some nice emails back. So, you know, I sent it to them all. A couple of people who I interviewed I didn't hear from, and I do worry about that. But, you know, also people have busy lives and may not have time to answer an email, and then you forget about it. But I hope I did. You know, I've reread the story since, and, like, there are moments where I'm like, I want to rewrite that entire section. Versus everything we write. Where you're like, you know, but you can, everything you write, once you hit that send button, you're like, yeah, give it back.
Don't worry about it
anymore. It's not done. Not done. God, my dad is a portrait painter. So he makes paintings, and he does this too. He agonizes over every little bit, and he always wants, like, you know, I've been with, like, the gallery openings with him with his stuff, and, you know, people are complimenting him, and they love it, and blah blah blah, and all he does is he sits there and stares at it, and has to, like, he's like I have to bite my own thumb in order to resist the temptation to rip something off the wall and be like, it's not done yet. Everybody go home. I gotta. And it's never done. It really isn't. Like any work of art that you spend a good amount of time on, and you're, from the purpose of being inside it, you're always going to feel like there's more you can do and more you could have fixed it. And you're right, to a certain extent. You can polish something till the end of time and never publish it, you know. And I mean, that's maybe okay. I'm thinking there's this theater artist that I once knew. She was, you know, her answer to this question was, is eventually she started making dance pieces that nobody could ever come see. And I asked her about this, and I was like, what did you say? So I asked her, I ran into her, you know, after not seeing her for 4 years, and I was like, what are you doing? Are you still making work and blah, blah, blah? And she said, oh, yes, I am. And I was like, oh, great. When's the next showing? And she said, oh, you can't come see it. And I was like, why? And she was like, because it's not about you. And I was like, well, me personally, or... what did I do wrong? She goes, no, I just, you know, I got too tired of waiting for an audience and wanting to know what the audience thought, so I just make pieces, and I work on them, and I finish them, and no one ever gets to see them. And that's one solution.
It doesn't feel like a great one, though.
You know, look, if you're just making it because you want to make something, maybe not everyone has to see it. Now, granted, it's a tough way to make a living.
Yeah.
But that is a choice. But yeah, you can agonize about, and you know, sometimes I like the fact when it's like, you know, someone needs like 1,000 words on something, and I don't think I've ever maybe written 2,000 words pieces in my life. I'm always like giving more to editors than they want, and they get angry. And it's like you got 3 hours to file, brother, and then there's no choice. So you say it as quickly and cleanly as possible, and you get sent, and whoop, it's gone. No choice. Done. So yes, the long answer to that question is I would like to think I did, and oh God, I love to have it back to keep working on it. But I want to go back out there. I don't know when I'm going to do it, but I'd want to go out there for a longer stretch of time and really like stay there and do something like Darcy Fry did with the book The Last Shot.
How long you were there for 10 days, right? How long did it take for you to really feel comfortable in both like in your setting, but also with approaching people, knowing that this is like, you don't have a familiarity with this topic or with these people at all?
You know, I got very lucky on the first couple of, I had some, you know, via the friend that first mentioned it, I had a couple of contacts.
Mm-hmm.
And those people were very nice about saying, yeah, I'll introduce you to this person. So that only took a couple of days. And I got really lucky there. And so, you know, within the first, and then I had a schedule where, you know, I would interview a couple of people and then go and watch the game at night and then come home and transcribe all my notes and then go to bed and get up and do it again. So it was a very, very busy day. So I didn't really have time to worry about being comfortable. I could just go and do it. So that only took a day or so. So, but, you know, in each individual interview, you know, it's a conversation, and it takes a while to figure out where you and the person you're talking to are going to meet. you know, I'd have a set of questions. And the interesting answers always came from something I couldn't have begun to predict walking in my preparation. Like, the things they said that were interesting were always, you know, and then I would say, oh, really? Tell me more about that. That was something I couldn't have predicted. You have to do the research, I think. You can't walk in and just say, oh, well, since the interesting things are going to happen, just if I can't work out ahead of time, I won't work out anything ahead of time. No, you have to come in with as much knowledge as you can beforehand and then be prepared to totally throw it away based on where the conversation you're having is going.
Did that happen to you often?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, pretty much every single time. Like, when I was talking with Mark Soldier Wolf, you know, I had questions about, like, you know, his workings with the Native American Affairs Committee and with the, you know, the Indian Affairs and with the government and with his, you know, his activism, and I don't think we ever got to it because he just started talking. And I was like, okay. I was like, that was like a three-hour interview at his house, just that. And he just talked, and I just listened. And a couple of times I said, can you tell me? Like, I almost did like a, can you talk about, a couple times? And that time I think it was a valid, like, so, talk about this, you know, and they just talk. And it don't look, you know, if you have a, look, when you're trying to, like, dragoon a quote out of a ball player, and I've been lucky enough that it's very rare that I have to do that. I do the talk about, I often have no idea what to say. It's, you know, if you're interviewing people who are interesting people, then they're going to, people want to tell their story, I think, is the bottom line. I think people are very excited to have someone sit down with them and say, listen, tell me your story. People want to tell their stories, basically. And it doesn't take much. Again, if you're ready to, like, just listen. And I think people, you know, it's tough to do, but it's really necessary.
Yeah, one of the first things that when we talked first at Sloan, I think it was two or three years ago now, almost. We were talking about writing dialogue, and one of the tips that you gave to me was you said just sit in any public place. Like, you gave, like, the subway as a good example, except we don't have that here. And you said just take out a notebook and just listen to conversation and just start writing down random people's conversations. You're going to look like a weirdo when you do it, but it's going to help you get, like, an understanding, not just for rhythm, but also, it, you know, for how people actually talk. But in that, the entire thing was really just lessons, just to listen and to not.
Yeah. This is an exercise that this really great teacher and playwright named Mac Wellman gave me. I did a brief 2-week workshop with him, a playwriting workshop. He runs a program at Brooklyn College. And that was the first exercise. The exercise was, you have to come back with 5 handwritten pages, single spaced, of dialogue, or you can type them up afterwards, he said. But what you have to do is you have to listen to people talk, and then when they're done, write it down as best you can remember it. You can't use a transcriber. You can't, like hide a recorder in places. But just listen to what they say and then write it down. And the interesting thing is, again, like what you said is, as a writing exercise, it's fascinating for a couple of reasons. One, because you realize, like, how circular and twisted people's way of speaking is. That nobody speaks in, like, a subject-verb-object kind of way, and then someone responds with complete clarity. People repeat themselves, and they say things that make no sense in response to what you just said. And you go around in circles, and, like, languages, like, conversations are very twisted things when you actually listen to how they're delivered. They're nothing like most TV and movies. They don't sound like that. And that's okay, because TV and movies, but the way that people actually speak is a different animal. And the second thing is, what you remember, unless you have a photographic memory, will be your writing style. Like, the way you write, the way you remember it will inevitably point to what parts of the dialogue interest you, and you're going to leave some stuff out, and you're going to, you know, forget other things, and you may embellish certain things in certain ways, and that's okay. But yes, like, just listening to the way people talk is, and stopping and really trying to listen to remember every single word and inflection. You have to write it down exactly. Like, if someone said, Well, I kind of think like you had to write well, dot, 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 period, pause. I kind of think, comma, like exactly as you remember it.
That would be horrifying for me if someone was listening in on my conversation.
Oh,
because I say like way too much, and I've been trying to catch myself with it recently. But I know if someone was doing that exercise, they'd write it back down. Say, how many times does that guy say like? Jesus.
Like, you know, it's like a problem.
It is. It's a huge problem.
I do it too. I do the same thing. I'm trying to exercise like and you know from my everyday speech. And it can comprise, you have to make a conscious effort, and it feels painful, like a machine whose gears are slipping, because you're catching that verbal tick, which is really just filler when you don't know what to say. So you can feel incredibly mechanical when you're talking and sound stilted and William F. Buckley-esque. I think it's a good lesson for actual clear speech. It's everywhere. It's rampant. It's like a plague. You're totally right. You're like totally like right.
my Sunday school teacher, my confirmation teacher, he'd make us start our sentences over, our entire thoughts over when we were speaking out loud. If we said like when not using it as, you know, a metaphor or simile or comparison, anything like that, he'd make us start the entire thing over.
That's painful. Oh, God, that sounds like the most horrible exercise I could imagine.
Painful, but kind of useful, honestly.
Sure. Oh, I'm sure it's useful. It's just, ugh. I don't think I'm one of the worst practicers of that. I don't think I'm bad at that. I don't think I do it a lot. And I'm totally wrong. I'm sure I do it all the time. Or do it as much as anybody else. I'd like to think that I have a vocabulary that I can speak with confidence, and I don't need these, you know. There, see? Right there. It happened right there. I've been completely hoisted by my own petard, where I don't need the verbal equivalent of, you know, liquefied, you know, meat product to fill in the gaps.
You're the second person who has come on Rise and Scribe to start talking about meat products.
That was the first was David Roth, right?
Yeah. Yes. He apparently has some affection for comparing people to meats, usually some form of ham, which is interesting for a Jew. But that's neither here nor there.
You see, he's getting rid of his desire to ingest pork products by writing about it. Because who would want to eat face meat? You know, who wants to eat someone else's face? And if you start comparing John Gruden, let's say, to an overcooked country ham, you might not want to eat country ham. I totally agree with that. It's therapy, really.
Or I think a favorite target of his is it Mike Francesca? Is that the radio host?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a serious animal byproduct / human being. he edited something I wrote. One of the first really long form things that I really liked, where I wrote that and I was like, oh, that's really cool. I wrote this thing for the Classical about Steve Novak, and he edited it, and I think he added mayonnaise complected to it. That was his editorial flair. I said his face looked like a kind of soft cheese that was also a deep sea creature that would react and contract in the face of a predator. But I think he threw the mayonnaise complected as a Rothian verbal flourish. He's a great editor, just to be clear. I've relished every single opportunity that I did there, relished every single opportunity that I've had to work with.
You've also put relish on every opportunity.
Yes, I have, quote, relished.
Sorry. You write for – how many different sites do you write for now? I know you do –
a lot. I do a lot. I do – when the sports world nudges its little camel's head under the tent – to the rest of the world for things political, social, scandalous issues. I write for the Daily Beast about that. And I also freelance for the Guardian for a bunch of different stuff. And occasionally I'll write something for Vice. And also very occasionally, I've got something coming for Deadspin, hopefully soon. And where else? And The Cauldron I've written for a bunch. And I think that's about it. A lot of different places. Anyone will take me. If you will pay me money, I will write for you about pretty much anything, really.
Well, the question I want to ask about that is, do you ever feel like your voice changes per site? I know that your topics will change and how they want you to address certain topics will change. But do you feel like your voice ever changes dependent on the outlet?
I think, that's an interesting question. I think, yeah, sure. I don't know if the voice will change. I'd like to think that it all still sounds like my stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think it does. But I think you have to change your tone to fit who you're writing for and the audience that that site attracts. Oh, my God. You're going to kill me with this, Mark.
Oh, Bobby, don't worry about it. You know it's going to be okay.
Oh, it's a misbehaved limb. Well, like I was saying, I think that, yes, I think you have to change your tone to suit the audience for that website. I think something that I'll write for the Daily Beast won't be the same as something for sure that I would write for Knickerblogger or the about.com Knick site that I write for, where I'm there's a bit more of a freewheeling spirit and I can write in a different tone. I think it's the difference between tone and voice. I don't think that's necessarily like I'm trying to, you know, it's this thing, again, not to make incredibly grandiose definitions about art when writing about basketball and other sports. I realize how pretentious that sounds. I'm well aware. But a piece of work is defined by the frame. And by that I mean, like, a frame is the structure that someone gives you to fill. So if I get something from the Daily Beast, there's a particular frame that I have to fill. And how I fill it in to create something is going to be different than you are or David Roth is or anybody else is. But that frame is going to be the same, mm-hmm. more or less. And I don't think that changes the way you work. But I think, you know, just from a practical point of view, you have to be you have to be honest about what they're asking. You know, it's in addition to quote-unquote art, it is a job. And a job is asking you to fulfill a specific task, and it's your job to bring as much of yourself to bear and whatever style you may have to fulfilling that job. But it will change, and it does change in tone. I mean, I feel like, there are times that I've written a very straight, you know, here's who, what, when, where, and why lead, and then here's some more evidence to support that, and then here's a quote from a person who I interviewed to further elaborate on that, and here's a nifty conclusion. And I've done that more in the past year now than I ever have in my life. And I'm trying to get, like, doing that and doing that well, that's hard. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a lesson that I've had to pick up on the fly. Like, when I was just me writing about the Knicks for fun, I would, you know, take my good, sweet time getting to even something approaching a lead. I've got a plate of food that I'm going to serve you, but I'm just going to sit around here and putz with the parsley and maybe adjust the table setting for like four or five paragraphs. And then maybe I'll put the plate down if I think you've earned it. and sometimes that can be fun and that can be great. And like, you know, leading a person into a story by really taking the time and going and then going somewhere with it and then exploring all the boundaries of that, having that kind of freedom, a larger frame to fill, if you will, is great, but the skill of being like, here's the story that you're going to be told, and then I'm going to explain it to you. That's very hard, and I think harder than a freewheeling Knicks recap where I like spend 5,000 words like doing a very bad Beckett, you know, knockoff and openly stealing huge chunks of a Beckett book because they lost to the Nuggets and then rewriting others to, like, somehow fit, you know, Benno Udry in there is a different kind of a difficult thing. But sure, yeah. So they're gonna, it's gonna be different, but it's all coming from, I think, you know, me and what I see. It's that same thing as that exercise. Like, you ask five people to listen to and then transcribe someone's conversation, and you're gonna get five totally different things. And that's okay. That's a good thing.
You brought up an interesting point, although a little bit sarcastically, but it's something that even I've struggled with, especially recently, when you said that not to make, you know, grandiose statements about sports writing and how it's just sports. Does that ever bother you, for lack of a better term? Meaning, does the fact that really you're just writing about sports ever kind of enter into your mind as, is this important when really all I'm doing is writing about someone putting a ball in a basket?
Right. I mean, gosh, does it bother me? No. No, it really doesn't. No is the short answer. The long answer is also no. But, sports is a central thing to our culture. It is in fact the only popular cultural thing that is shared across all political, ethnic, and social and economic lines. It's incredibly central to American life, and it's also a major multi-billion-dollar industry. I think there are a million topics in the world of sports, including and outside, you know, both in terms of what occurs on the field of play and what occurs off it, that one could write about and write about well and write about eloquently and one write about artistically and one write about poetically, that in no way that can't be diminished by someone saying, yeah, it's just sports. And I'm saying, you know, or you know, you might as well say, yeah, it's just television, or yeah, it's just movies, or yeah, it's just food, or yeah, it's just, you know, it's just politics. You know, it's very rare, like, you can point to a piece of writing and say, well, this is important, what I'm doing. This is actually going to change and affect people's lives. That's a rarity.
Mm-hmm.
That's very, very rare. It's so rare that, like, people make movies like All the President's Men about it when it does happen. So, yeah, it is just sports, but it's not really just sports. I mean, and feel free to diminish it if you want. There are plenty of people in this world who don't care at all about sports. That's okay. We care about other things. I care about it, and I know a lot of other people who do, and it doesn't make people silly for caring about it, or caring about the results of, you know, that thing of like, well, it's just a game. Why do you care what happens? No, it's like, okay, I guess you can say in some idealized society, then no one would care, but we do. So let's talk about it. And let's talk about why we care about it. That's a reasonable conversation to have. I'll have a conversation with anybody about why people care about it. And I've certainly written myself in a particularly navel-gazing way about why I care about it. but that thing, that part of it has never bothered me. I mean, and for people who just want to say, well, I just want to break down how Team Y defends the pick and roll, and anything more than that feels like a pretension or feels like someone's adding something on to the games that shouldn't be there. I'm like, look, you're fully free to write about how a team defends the pick and roll. And I will read your article in depth about how someone defends the pick and roll, because I care about that too, especially since I work for a team that still doesn't know how to defend the pick and roll. I would like to think that theoretically, somewhere, someone has figured out this grand mystery of the universe. So I will read it. But I will also read someone saying, making a statement like how they defend the pick and roll is, you know, akin to like the mating, you know, the mating dance of a deep sea fish or something like that. you know, or whatever. or I will say that, like, you know, the fact that you can't defend the pick and roll is indicative of a greater systemic rot and how that relates to, you know, late period capitalism. I'll read that too. I find all that stuff interesting. I think dismissing, like, if someone's going to write with intelligence and you know, and well, and write with, you know, and I like people who write good about all kinds of things. And if you can do that, I'll find a way to care about it. And I think you'll find an audience that will care about it, too. And dismissing it out of hand as, well, it's just this topic that I don't care about, I think points back to what we were talking about. Like, it doesn't matter what you care about. Be interested in what someone else cares about. You know, you've known for your entire life what you care about. I certainly have known for my entire life what I care about. And at a certain point, the things that I care about and my problems and my passions, those are boring. Because we all get bored of our own little problems. And all our problems are, for the most part, pretty minimal and boring. Be interested in what someone else cares about. Because if they're taking the time to write about it, obviously they care about it. I mean, or maybe not. I mean, if they're taking the time to write about it and write about it well, it's obviously something they have a passion for. And be more interested in them. Again, not to go back to, you know, old theater war stories, but there's this one point. It was when it was my first year of grad school, and I was miserable, which is ludicrous on face value, because I was like, I was living in France. I was getting like half my rent paid for by the French government as a foreign student, because they do that there. So my rent was like $100 a month or something crazy like that after my government subsidy. And so I was working one day a week, going to class 6 hours a day, and spending the rest of the time sort of strolling around Paris being miserable. Crazy. It was crazy. And I was miserable because I was like, I couldn't get this exercise right, and I couldn't do what this teacher wanted right, and I didn't like that they liked this student so much because I hated that student, and why was he such a suck-up? Can't everyone else see that? I certainly can. And, you know, a whole litany of dumb student problems. And a friend of mine who's an older actor was in town with a show, and I said, hey, let's get together, I'll buy you lunch. So we got together, and he's like, so, I think he said something like, so, how's it going? And I went into a 20-minute monologue about how I was trained this way, and they're asking me to do something different, and they're wrong, and I'm right, and I can't do this, and it's driving me nuts, and they're also French, and blah, 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 you know. Bitching a blue streak. And he sits there, and he nods, and he listens. And he's like, that's really fascinating, Bob. And he lets me, like, talk myself out until I'm too tired and I've ranted and raved and screamed in this lovely, lovely cafe in Paris. Again, let's keep in mind. And he says, here's the thing. You know, I was reading this article on the way up about this idea that scientists are trying to perfect a clock that's better than the atomic clock. Because the atomic clock doesn't keep perfect time. It'll lose like a minuscule millisecond every like X number of years, and they have to keep torquing it slightly. It's not perfect. So they're trying to build a better perfect clock than the atomic clock. And the question you might first ask is, well, why? Why would they do that? Because the atomic clock is pretty good, and if you need to like tweak it that much, why do you need to spend time, money, and energy to make it slightly better? And he says, the reason that it is because if you have a clock that's keeping absolutely perfect time, maybe you'll want to have a human race around in 5,000 years to see what time it is. And it's sort of like the idea that the whole, you know, environmental movement and didn't really get started until the first pictures from space came back in 1960, in the 60s, where they saw, you know, for the first time ever. And that fact still blows my mind, that up until, like, 1960-something, no one had seen the planet Earth, the whole thing. And that movement really got started around, like, look, here's this giant planet. Look at it. Let's try to keep it. And he tells me this story, and he says, in any way, he goes, you know, I think, you know, theater is kind of like that, in this way. That, you know, every time you step on a stage, whether you're in a play or in a class or in a rehearsal or whatever, there's 5,000 years worth of history behind you of people who've been doing this. And hopefully there'll be another 5,000 years of people doing it long after you and I, Bob, are dust. And that's an amazing power to have, to realize that you're part of something that is so much bigger than you, that's been going on for thousands of years, before and after you're gone. But the only way to kill it, the only way to really have that power, is to realize that it's not about you. And that kind of stopped me dead in my tracks. It made me go, oh, yeah, you're right. And I think that's right for any like thing that you're doing that has, again, this kind of an idea of an artistic end, that it's never about you. It's about what you encounter. And so, in a very long about an anecdote-strewn way, I guess what I'm trying to say is this, that's something that I always try to remind myself when I'm working on a story, is that it's you know, take notes, observe, listen, and be interested in someone else's world, because you know yours to the nth degree. Theirs is going to surprise you. It's always going to be more interesting.
Well, Bob, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much. And also always sit in the back, because people will think you're cool.
Okay.
A bit of blood, but always in any situation. Always sit in the back. People will think you're cool.
All right. Well, thanks. Appreciate it, man.
Thank you, Jordan.
All right. Talk to you soon.